Okay. Hi, everybody. Nice to see you. This is not my farewell talk. This is my see you soon talk. I'm stealing two jokes from the Sangha that people gave me. One, it's my see you soon talk, not my farewell talk, before I hungry ghost you all for the spring. Anyway, what are we going to do today? I'm a little bit tired, and I've been kind of frazzled and running around and getting stuff, so I'm not all there. So we'll see if I have a coherent talk. I don't think it's coherent talk, but we'll see if we have a good time anyway. Let me just start you with, I have overhauled all the ceremony stuff, which I'm really excited about. I know a lot of people don't make it to most of the ceremonies, which is fine. Robert's taking over the caretaking duties while I'm gone. And a lot of people don't actually know Robert. I think it's one of the kind of funny things about it. And it kind of proves my point that I haven't made yet. Told you I was frazzled. But he comes to almost every morning sit. He does all the Friday morning ceremonies with me. And to me, what's fun about that is it is the least attended thing we do, but it's also the real heartbeat of the place. Daily Zazen, the morning altar rounds, and the Friday morning ceremony. As long as that stuff stays alive, we are a proper Zen center. Almost anything else we do is fine. We have board game night on Monday nights instead. It's fine as long as we have morning Zazen and the Friday morning ceremony is done reasonably accurately to tradition. So anyway, so Robert will be taking over that. But I finally overhauled the whole thing and I read this to you a while ago. I did a translation of the Zazen Shin, which is a two-part poem by Hongzhi and Dogen. And one of the things we were waiting on, I translated a couple of things that are now in our canon, and I've been tinkering with them all year, and Robert keeps getting annoyed at me because I keep changing the words every week or so on the ones that I did, because I'm never quite happy with it. I promise, my solemn promise is that as of Friday when I leave, it's set in stone until, I won't touch anything until 2025, nothing else changes. So this is the overhaul. Anyway, the point is we retooled the Zazen Shin, so I think it works now. Anyway, let me read you the Zazen Shin. This is a poem that Hongzhi wrote, the first half of the poem, in the, I believe, 12th century, 1100s. And then Dogen, 100 years later, came along and wrote a nice essay on it and then wrote a part two to it. And he said, that poem was great. I'm not saying anything bad about the poem, but here's what I would say also. Here's the poem. Zazen Shin, which means guidance for Zazen. The critical art of every Buddha, the art of the heart of every ancestor, was to know without seeing, to light without shining. Knowing without seeing, they naturally knew the subtleties. Lighting without shining, their light had a natural grace. Naturally knowing the subtleties, their thinking made no distinctions. With the grace of their light, not a hair's breadth was missed. Thinking without making distinctions, their understanding was wonderfully rare. Not missing a hair's breadth, their light was aimless and true. The water is clear down to the bottom. The fish are swimming slowly, slowly. The sky is wide open and boundless. The birds fly far, far away. So that was Hongzhi's poem. And here's Dogen's response. The critical art of every Buddha, the art at the heart of every ancestor, was to be without reason, to be self-fulfilled. Being without reason, they were naturally kind. Self-fulfilled, they had nothing to prove. Their kindness was natural, so could not be tainted. With nothing to prove, their fulfillment could not be true or skewed. Their kindness untainted wasn't given away, it fell from them on its own. With nothing to prove, neither true nor skewed, their efforts had no design. The water is clear down to the ground, the fish are swimming like fish. The sky is wide open to heaven, the birds are flying like birds. I love that. I feel like it really is guidance for Zazen and all things Zen. I see two big themes in it between Hongzhi and Dogen's. Hongzhi's first. Well, one thing that was striking about the poem that I haven't seen captioned in a lot of other translations, but definitely, and I'm no Chinese expert, but I'm getting more familiar with it. And things it did that were odd was it had a time and a who, which is usually the things they leave out, a when and a who does things. It was definitely once and they. And that was such a rarity. It was like very striking, very nostalgic, kind of touching. It was like harkening back to like the lost golden age. But I love that Dogen is our lost golden age, who is studying Hongzhi as a lost golden age, who is harkening back to the lost golden age. And I love when we kind of admit that. Anyway, so I thought that was striking. But the ancient art, it's that naturally knowing the subtleties, the small, the nuanced, it's very much about, I don't know, that's the mind of Zazen. It's the nuance and subtleties. When I did that talk on the stages of faith over the retreat that I'm going to, but it's going to be on the podcast soon if you haven't heard it, but it's a whole thing. You can listen to it. But the takeaway was one of the things that kind of separates certain kind of understandings of self and the world. One criteria you can make is whether or not you're able to accept people in their own understanding of the world without needing to agree or disagree with them and just let that be fine. And you don't have to understand how they understand their worldview. It's just okay enough that they have one. It's different from yours. And that's just as true as yours. And you don't need to make that work out logically. The ability to hold two contradictory things in your head at the same time and not need to reconcile them. That was a big part of that. And I feel like when I read this, understand the subtleties, the knowing without seeing, the lighting without shining, that kind of natural grace that allows you to kind of actually see everything without making distinctions. That's kind of what I feel like they're talking about. The not needing to sum things up so you can hold things in their peculiarness without needing to make it make narrative sense, let's say. This is always my whole thing. To make things make narrative sense or cognitive sense in a satisfying way, you've really got to cut off so many of the edges of things. You really got to like force them into a box they don't want to be in to make things solid and sensible. And I feel like that's not what they're talking about. It's a much more patient and light touch. Anyway, the subtleties. So that there was that one. And then in the Dogen, the big thing that I really took away that I love so much that I think is good advice for Zen practitioners is the that self-fulfilled thing. That's kind of the basis for every reason you can trust these people or trust anybody. People who are self-fulfilled, which is kind of a strange term. When I was trying to render, I had a lot of trouble with that one because it was not a common phrasing he used. It was something like without mutually turning around. And everyone in English kind of makes all kinds of weird ways to translate. No one kind of gets the same thing out of it. And it was, yeah, come to completion, fulfillment, or achievement without a mutual turning around, without reciprocity was kind of the idea, or a sharing back and forth. So I finally just dropped the without format and did self-fulfilled. Cause I feel like that's what that meant, was like, especially in the context of everything else, self-fulfilled having nothing to prove. To me, that is, when I remember that, when I can live up to that in myself, it's the thing that makes everything just work. When I'm acting maturely, when I feel like I'm acting like a grown-up, it's when I am not reliant on others or other external things for my fulfillment. I feel like that really is true. And that's, I think, what starting at the wall's for, when we sit there and try to get comfortable with nothing else happening, just yourself. If that's uncomfortable, A, why are you not entertained? And B, why is it so difficult to sit in your own stuff? And to me, it's a matter of, are you enough for yourself? And I feel like everything Dogen says in there is really the benefits of learning how to be enough for yourself, which mostly is natural kindness, nothing to prove. To me, people I can really trust. I have nothing to prove, neither true nor skewed. I wanted to say neither right nor wrong. It's implying neither right nor wrong, but there are better ways. There are more clear ways to say right or wrong. It said true or skewed. So I went with what it actually said, also because it rhymed. So I was on board. But it's really with nothing to prove, nothing can be right or wrong. Like we're always saying everything fundamentally perfect means right or wrong don't apply here. Anyway, those are the themes. And of course, I see them as going together. If you want to understand the nuances of things and not need to force them into little boxes to make them make sense and kind of lie to yourself about what's happening, see things honestly in their own weirdness, then that self-fulfilled component's important because that's where, like he says, no designs. When you don't have designs on the outside world, it's much easier to see it honestly. And then, to me, seeing the subtleties and seeing things honestly, Well, that's kind of how you make peace with yourself. I keep noticing this year, especially, my favorite teachers all talk about not what they've learned, not what they understand, but where they fail, where they have things to work on, where they're still confused. And I feel like it's much easier to do that when you're okay with everything else kind of being a little bit nebulous and out of whack, because then you can be like, well, I don't need to make sense either. I don't need to always be right. I don't need to always be good. And yeah, so it's a feedback loop. If you can see the world as not adding up, it's easier to accept yourself as not adding up. When you accept yourself as not adding up, and just as you are, then it's much easier to be honest with the world. Anyway, that's the theory for the night. I just wanted to do some theory and read a poem I like. The point is, I'm leaving soon, and I was going to talk about that. I'm a little discombobulated like last time, but last time was way, way worse. This has been way easier process to get ready to go this time, to go to the monastery for 3 months, for the people who don't know. I went exactly the same time last year, and last time was completely different. I was very intimidated and scared last year, and I didn't want to go. I was pissed. I was resentful. It was a lot more work because I wasn't prepared, and I was just kind of scared and upset. And I was just moving until the moment I left, just trying to get things ready to go. And I still didn't do enough. And it was awful. And I showed up, just, holy shit, what has happened? But this time is different. This time I'm kind of, I might even be looking forward to being there. Maybe that's delusional. I probably shouldn't look forward to being there. I may have kind of like rosied it up in my head. I've heard, I don't know, I've never been pregnant. I don't understand how that works internally. But I've heard that there's a chemical that's released in people's bodies that makes you forget the horror of how painful it was. So if I want to do it again, I can't back up that science. But as a metaphor, I love it. That you go through this terrible thing and then you just get flooded with this forgetfulness. So you're like, oh, let's go. Let's try that again. That's how I feel. Maybe I'm doing that this time. Because I hated it last time. All I did was complain for 3 months and just count down the minutes. Those last 3 days, the last 24 hours I was there was the longest 24 hours of my life. Like watching the clock being like, I get to leave soon. I get to leave soon. 24 hours had never passed so slowly as watching that clock that day. So I don't know why I'm looking forward to going back a little bit and why it sounds kind of nice. I know there's one thing about it. I'm not angry about going this time. I feel like I'm choosing to go. Like I was there last time. I saw what I got out of it and I saw what was there. And I have a lot of respect for what was there and for the process, even with as much as I didn't like it. And as kind of miserable and weird as the whole thing is, I'm choosing to go willingly. It's weird. In the last year, and I don't know if like Gyokei is some kind of weird wizard of an ambassador for Sodoshu, because all he does is talk shit about Sodoshu, and all I do is get more and more on board with the institution the longer we work together. I wonder, is that a move or is that just how it works out? But I've kind of fully bought in by now to the Sodoshu training process. I feel like I got things out of there that I haven't seen available in training in the States. And even if I don't like it, even if I don't want to be there, I'd much rather just stay and go to the beach and hang out with my friends. And obviously, but I don't know, I feel like anybody bake bread, bread bakers or not bread bakers, there's a move. And I was also pissed when I learned this move. The Tartine bread book taught me a move that I wish I had known, that most of the world needs their dough. Do you know this? Most doughs are dry. You need it. Like, and when I first started doing pizza dough at the bar I was working at, I would make them knead 30-pound dough balls, 600 strokes every day, and they hated me for it. And I was like, that's how you make good bread, and I can't afford a mixer. That's how you make good bread. And so we do these 600 strokes, this big thing, and it was a lot of work. And then the Tartine book taught me that if you just, apparently French have known this for centuries and maybe didn't tell anybody, but if you make your dough slightly wetter, and if you just fold up the corners in your bin, once every half hour, just do one turn, just like four times around, and let it sit for a half hour. It does the same thing as all the work of you kneading it. You fold the glutens, and then the glutens keep working themselves in your absence. Then you do it again, half hour later, you do this four times. And that total of 16 folds, it takes like no energy or effort or time, does the work of 600 strokes on the tabletop. And I was like, what? You don't have to knead your dough? Anyway, I feel like since I got home, the glutens have been processing. And I feel like I'm due for my next turning. I'm gonna go get my next set of turns. That's how I see it. So I'm not angry about it. Everything feels different that way. And also too, just to, I don't wanna talk about why I've kind of bought into Sodoshu. I'm gonna try to like do this delicately and not break any vows. Not picking and choosing and not talking about other people's stuff. But if I'm looking to role models for, That's the tricky part about Zen. There's a lot of beautiful teachings, a lot of grand ideas, a lot of stuff you might get from doing it. I don't know how to say this less plainly. But one of my big problems in Zen was I always respected and looked up to what was on the page and what was in the practice. But when I looked around at the examples of people who had done those things for a very long time, I often was left with kind of a pause of like, wait, is that 20 years of this practice? Is that something I aspire to myself? And that often confused me because I could feel it working what it felt like well on me. But when I looked at people who've been doing it for a long time, I wasn't necessarily as inspired by what I saw. That sounds terrible, but I don't know how else to say that. But I will say working with Soto Shu monks has been different. And I don't know, for better or for worse, it could just be because most of the monks I meet are Japanese, and so it's much easier to not view people critically if they're not from your same culture, because there's always that little bit of a gap, which makes it easier to not see things the same. But what I've noticed is just a matter-of-fact professionalism about practice and the priesthood in general, that's what I aspire to. The version of me that was on the line, when we had the good crew in a restaurant, just like doing good work, kind of talking to shit, taking it seriously when you needed to and not when you don't. And a good, hard, honest day's work about something you care about. But other than that, let's talk some shit and have fun. That's what I've seen with Soto Shu monks compared to the examples I got in America. And I'm much more inspired by that, maybe because I was a line cook. But I get a similar vibe. And I'm like, okay, we have less cursing and less cocaine. No, I've seen no cocaine in Soto Shu. Sorry, to be clear. Zero cocaine in Soto Shu. But other than that, a similar work ethic and respectability and sincerity that I appreciate. Anyway, I'm not trying to kiss ass right now. My point is, I'm going because I want to, which is very different. Last time I had a whole list of people. When I first arrived there, I just spent the first few weeks in my head with my list of people that I was angry at for why I had to be in this prison camp, just loop on a loop. So I never got over it. I just got bored of it and did something else. I never decided I was wrong or I was silly. I just moved on to other things to think about. Anyway, that's all different. Sorry, I'm just embarrassing Gyoke. Gyoke has done a lot for me this year, and he is my sponsor for this whole situation and getting me there and everything. I think sponsor is a good word for this, because like, vouched for me, and I wouldn't be able to do any of this without that stamp of approval and that connection. And that means a lot, because he's got a whole career with these people. So when he sends me over there, if I really screw it up, it doesn't reflect well on him. It's kind of a gamble. But what roped me in initially, and it's something he's told his own story. It's all back on the podcast about why he ended up in Soto Shu. It resonated with me from a story I'd heard of. I talked about Ikkyu a lot. You guys know the monk Ikkyu. He was a 14th century Rinzai monk, not our team, but also awesome. His poetry is fantastic. Also very dirty. He curses a lot, which is why I like him. Actually, I found him because I was looking up Japanese erotic poetry. The only thing that came up was Ikkyu, the monk from the 14th century. But his story was great. The very brief version is that he was kind of a snotty brat. He was the son of an emperor who, for political reasons, could not be involved in politics. So they shunted him off to a monastery. So he's in this weird position where he kind of has a sense of entitlement because he's the emperor's kid, but also no opportunity to go off and do anywhere of anything of importance anytime because he, for political reasons, he's been sidelined. And so he's got this air of invincibility about him, but no purpose. And so this really comes across in his life story and his poetry where he's kind of this snide and crusty character. Like I said, he drinks a lot. He swears a lot. He loves sex, just so much sex in his poetry in graphic detail. And he's very anti-establishment. He just hates the system. As a kid, he writes about, you know, the abuse and physical, sexual, just all the stuff that would happen in monastery, especially back then. There's a moment in the, never mind. The manga version has some graphic moments like, oh, I'm so sorry, Ikkyu, Jesus. So he just, his whole life, he then kind of spent being like the renegade monk and talking a lot of shit on the system. He tore up his enlightenment certificate and told his monks, what do you want this kind of crap for? And then at the end of his life, though, there had been another civil war, and the temple he kind of came up in, the one that he hated so much and railed against for years, had been burned down and destroyed. And as an old man, they asked him to, would he come back and be the abbot of that temple and rebuild it? And he said yes. And he did it, and it killed him. He worked his ass off trying to rebuild this place, and that's where he died, was rebuilding the temple that abused him as a kid. I'm like, that's beautiful. I don't know if that's Stockholm syndrome. I don't know if that's compassion. Yeah, I think the lines are fuzzy, but that inspired me. And that's what, that's similar to the story Gyokei told about going back into Sotoshu. Because what, when I go to a place like the monastery, I'm angry at people and I have all my reasons for being angry. And I'm not wrong. That's the thing. But how helpful is it to sit there and let that rule my life? And what I was taught when I got to start working with Sotoshu was no one is optional. And that's what I saw in the monastery too. You can't get rid of people no matter how problematic they are, no matter how much you wish you could. And even if you can, you're kind of kidding yourself. And so what do you do then? And that to me feels like a proper monastic vow, is that you're, when they say no picking and choosing, when they say no love or hate, it's admitting that nothing's actually optional, which doesn't mean don't be skillful. I still try to be skillful sometimes. You know, sometimes you do what you have to do. You make, to me, like I've, and I don't even actually know what the blinds are supposed to be. My line is, prevent harm, obviously prevent harm. But outside of preventing harm, you're not just trying to make the world the way you want it by arranging people and places to suit your preferences. In the old mythology, well, there's two stories in the old mythology. One is that if you're really good in this lifetime, you can go to Pure Land where everybody is nice and nobody competes and everyone gets along and everyone gets enlightened eventually and it's great. So there's a place better than this. And then the other version is that this is the Pure Land, and if you can't see it, that's your mistake. And that's up to you to figure out why you can't see this world as awesome as Buddha saw it. And I haven't seen the Jeweled Wonderland that he said he saw. But I like that challenge. To me, that challenge sounds much harder, for one, but also more honest. All right, I'm going to read you something. This is the, for the new ceremonies, one thing that I really want to do for the ceremonies, I think I am just trying to like plug the ceremonies. Join on Friday mornings, join for the full moon ceremonies. I really do believe it's the heart of what we do. So the way these things work is that, so we'll chant the Heart Sutra, we'll chant the Zazen Shin. And these things are, it's only a slightly rewording of the old mythology. The old mythology is you gain karmic merit points by doing good deeds and we then transfer those merit points to other people. That sounds like myths that we don't, a lot of us don't believe in. But if you just kind of retool that, those words, like this poem, like I get a lot out of it. In the Heart Sutra, I've got a lot out of chanting it. We get good things out of doing this. And then just internally, intentionally, we then dedicate that benefit that we get to other people, to everyone in the world. And so for a long time, since we kind of got our ceremonies handed down, we were just trying to do them right when we started this place. And so we had a version of San Francisco's. We wanted to keep it simple so we wouldn't turn people off or make it too complicated. So at the end of these chants, you chant the chants, and then we'll then call out the dedication, which is like the why and who and what it was for and who we're dedicating it to, which is the kind of part to like say something nice and make it worthwhile. But we didn't really understand what we were doing, and so we just kind of took the simplest version of the words we could find to do it correctly. What we were left with was kind of a dry and just kind of dedicating it to dead people whose names you probably might not know if you haven't been here for a long time, which was a little bit, I felt like, kind of doing a disservice to the ceremonies, people coming to not actually say what it was for. So I went through the Sotoshu book and the other dedications I found around and tried to do an appropriate version of, so this is our dedication. I'm just going to read it to you. So after we chant something like the Zazen Shin, we would chant, well, one person would then say, humbly we call on Buddha's kindness and illuminating wisdom. Having chanted the Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra and the MHU Kanangyo or something else, dedicate the benefits to, and then first we dedicate it to the ancestors, so Buddha, Mahaprajapati, the first woman ancestor, Bodhidharma Dogen Kazon. And then we keep on going. To all generations who transmitted the flame down through the ages, to the founder of our Sangha, Nishijima Roshi, and all the teachers who gave their efforts to spread the Dharma across the world, may we reflect and repay their kindness. I forget what it used to say. But I like the idea that if we're going to call out all these old ancient names, all these people, just as a name check, it's also the idea is that they passed this down. They kept it going and passed it down, just like we're doing now. And in gratitude for that service, to pay them back, we've got to try to live good lives and be decent people. I think that's, I don't know. I like that. That's the dedication. I'll chant to that. We also offer the benefits to the spirits of the center, our friends and loved ones we remember and miss. We have them on the altar now. She who hears the cries of the world, Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of perfect wisdom, Manjushri. You can do what you want with spirits and archetypes. You can believe in them or just believe in their spirits of archetypes. Compassion and wisdom live in the center. We're going to dedicate our efforts to them. May truth flourish everywhere. May all beings find peace and dwell in harmony. May there be prosperity across the world and everyone have all they need. May the center be a place of serenity. May we all realize perfect understanding. Gratefully, we offer our benefits to all beings. So that's our dedication. And in general, the nice thing is even just these sits and this talks. And you know, if you come here because you've heard the meditation is good for you, listen to a talk because maybe you want to learn something that might help you, you are doing something good. You are creating a good benefit. And just so you know, this is what that's what I think we're doing it for. That's my intention. You know, that's why I'm here. And that's why I think most people who are kind of end up in leadership, we kind of ask them to understand that you're not just doing it for you. And you're not just doing it. I don't know why you're doing it, why that you're doing it, but it really is for everybody. Just like it was passed down to us, we're like keeping this thing alive for everybody. Anyway, I could say a lot more, but I'm not gonna. I've rambled at you. That's my pep talk. I hope you all have a nice spring. I'd love to hear your thoughts and your comments and your questions. Any thoughts on the poem? I love talking poetry. I had a poetry degree once. I still do. But did I say that ever? Dude, being a priest is just like the best poet gig ever because they already wrote the words for you. You can stand up there and say them, but like we've been whittling them down for 1,000 years or two, and it's all done for you. You can just stand up there and say the right words at the right time. It's great. And you have a role, a function. Anyway, thoughts, questions, comments?
Thanks so much, Dave. Just first of all, I wish you all the best. Just from the conversation I had with your Dharma sister, Doshin, yeah, she said the same thing. She hated it the first time, but she ended up loving that place. So she went there, ended up going there 4 times. So yeah. See you one night. So anyway, yeah, it's really interesting to see how you go through this whole processing. I did it much more miserably. I didn't do it as skillfully as you do. So that's a deep respect to you on that. Now, I was just thinking of this thing, observing through the American organization and Japanese Totoshi organization. And we're trying to create this new third group for to invite this new blood to Soto Zen in North America. And I can see you coming as a new blood to this whole new stream of Soto Zen in. And then what I think I've been sensing is like we have confrontations. You see that all the time. And this personality differences and all that. And then when that happens in an American context, I feel like it's like when it happens, it's done. And then you realize in Soto Shu, it happens all the time, but then there's a part of me, you're not really taking that seriously. And then it just continues on from that point. I'm not sure if I'm wrong because I'm still observing this carefully. And because we're here to talk about these divisions, non-dualities, so I don't know. I'm not nowhere near anywhere I can have any sort of conclusion on that.
I do think that was actually one of the most, as much as I complained, again, I felt really comfortable and at home there last time. I felt really like almost like I could drop my guard in a lot of ways. And I do think part of it was that no one's allowed to leave. You're all locked together. And by week 2 or 3, everybody has seen everybody at their worst. Everybody's been snippy. Everybody's hated somebody for a certain point. And you can't hide it at a certain point. You try to, they don't like it when you snap at each other in public. That was frowned on. But in general, conflict happens, but no one's allowed to leave. And so it just doesn't matter. That's the thing. So I did feel like I could drop my guard and just kind of be myself after a while because you weren't going to impress anybody anyway after a while. You can't really hide or show up. It's just, yeah. But the fact that this one thing I don't know if this is me because I moved around a lot in my life. And so a lot of my relationships have been temporary or tenuous. And the fear that if you get in conflict, it's going to be the end of the people you're close to. I don't know. I feel like that's always kind of riding on me. And it was just nice to know that, no, you all can get in a fight. You all can be jerks to each other. And in the morning, it's just easier to get along again anyway. I think actually, yeah, the third night there, I won't name the issue, but it was a very sensitive, hot button political issue that I have been personally involved in that my roommate from Missouri just said, and we had kind of already started to like be kind of like fun best friends. He smoked too. We were smoking buddies. And then the second night we got into some stuff. And I was just like, what the hell are you? Like, I cannot do this with you. And I was like, I was actually offended, you know, really upset by like what he was saying about things that I had done that are political hot button issues. And the next day, I was like, kind of bummed because I thought I had a friend. And I was like, well, this is going to be awkward because we're roommates. And then the next morning, honestly, it was the first opportunity I got where I was like, you know what? I'm going to compliment him. It's just easier. And his like the relief on his face when I just said something like goofy and complimentary, I think he'd done a good job of, I was impressed at the way he had done one of the ritual functions. And I just told him that. And like, just like, oh, thank God, we're fine. And from then on, it was just easy. And then another guy, the guy who wrote, did I show everybody the thing that wrote on my farewell card? Stay there. Okay, ask about conflict. It was my nemesis, the guy I was commissioned to go get in a fight with because he was being a jerk and then knew I would get away with it. Anyway, my farewell card he wrote, and he doesn't speak English, remember this, so he must have translated this in Google Translate. At first I thought you were a loud bastard, but now that I've spent some time near you, I've come to understand your kindness and your hatefulness. Take care. That's how I want to handle conflict. I have never felt so seen in my life. Most people who like me deny my hatefulness. So anyway, that's all I got for you tonight. I forgot to mention in my talk. I'm so sorry. The most important thing, there was a flow to it. I was supposed to talk about how I feel like I've kind of grown up a lot this year in my Zen practice, but it's gone in tandem with the center. I just feel like the maturing process of this place in the last few years, and I'm looking at a few of you in the eye, but you can't tell who. Anyway, the maturing process of this Sangha and this center over the last few years has just been like, I don't know. I don't want to say I beyond my expectations because that sounds rude, but like it really has surprised me how much we've really kind of, I don't know. I don't know what you guys think about Soto Shu exactly. We don't talk about it that much, but we used to have a real kind of more an antagonist energy and kind of that loosey-goosey, proud of our bad news bearsness. And then when we were doing the Dharma combat and Henry was like, stop saying we don't like ceremonies. I was like, oh yeah, maybe I should. Because he was really into it. A lot of us really kind of take that stuff seriously and do it. But also we've still kept that kind of lighthearted touch to it, which just overjoys me. Like, can we keep the goofy lightheartedness of being rebel antagonists, but also with the sincerity of caring? Can we care and be funny at the same time? And you know what I've seen us do? That. And that delights me. Thank you, everybody. And also just like the pitching in and the, I can tell, not to get too personal, how things have changed, because I could complain a lot about my position a few years ago. And what I can say is different now is that I don't think people would let me be in bad situations here anymore. And that just tells me that people, I don't know, are treating the whole place differently than we used to. And so thank you all for everything and everything you're going to do while I'm gone. I'm really excited. I don't really feel scared about leaving the place this time, because I feel like there's like 8 of you. One of you will figure it out, I hope. If not, it'll be fine. Maybe 12 of you. I think it's 12 or 13 people running this place while I'm gone. So awesome. Anyway.
This might be my favorite Dharma talk I've ever heard you give. It sort of pulls together like a lot of threads. And I like the new translation of the Zazen Shin. I think I like the new thing that you're doing with the ceremonies. But I really appreciate everything you said about what went into those choices. And it's funny because actually, like, the whole time since you've been back from your last dango, I have been like, did your feelings about why you were there and your frustration about it, and has all that changed? Because it seems like it's changed. I mean, it sounds unconscionable to me still, like the state of things at the monastery. But I've also heard you talk a lot about like the things that were positive outcomes for you from that. So I wanted to say I really appreciate that. And I've seen a lot of the changes that you're talking about, even as someone who's like new to Zen, it's past like year and change. So, and then the other thing is, the one thing that really was still struggling with in like this version of the Zazen Shin, and that I know is like a thing that comes up repeatedly as a thing people struggle with in Zen, and it has to do with, like you were saying, about holding two contradictory things in your mind and letting them both just exist the way they are and not needing to reconcile them and keeping around people you would rather get rid of and this and that. And it's like, there's a way in which, yeah, that could potentially save a lot of frustration and denialism and all these other things in a way that it's like more compassionate, but also like I think it can potentially allow for a lot of duplicity and hypocrisy. And I'm not talking about in any one particular situation, just I know that a lot of times people who are really good at accepting two contradictory things and rolling with that, they're often doing a lot of lying and cheating and like even to themselves. And that there is something to be said about just going for integrity. And so that's, I think, the one part of this talk that I feel like not really good about, because I can see like a lot of pitfall and dangers there and perpetuating things that might be like karmically really bad.
That's a really good question. I hadn't really considered that in that way before. Obviously, yeah, and actually they joke about it. In the Lotus Sutra, it opens with Buddha kind of admitting that a lot of what he had said before might not be true, is the opening. And they call it it's a skillful means. Buddha will say whatever you need to hear to get you the truth is what Buddha will say, and therefore his previous teachings don't need to be taken at face value. I.e., you can say Buddha's admitting to maybe having lying, and they even tell a story about being duplicitous to get your children out of a burning house in time, as in being duplicitous is, yeah. So it's what people often question Zen for being amoral. I don't think Zen is amoral, but it is something that does come up, and there's a lot of literature written about it that's worth kind of looking at that back and forth and looking inside. What I can say for myself for certain is that what I have realized for myself is that to hold one thing steady and true as true usually, that to me doesn't feel honest anymore. If I'm dealing with somebody who is hurting me or even just in conflict with me, and they've got this whole reality in their heads, and even if I think mine is more moral and more rational, in that person's head, that is not true. There's a whole universe that exists where everything that I know for certain is not true. And so for me to work with that person in any kind of honest way, to empathize with them, I have to accept that their reality is true for them. And that's where not adding it up becomes necessary. So for me, truth comes from empathy and compassion. Because otherwise I have to deny that person's reality exists and say that your existence is wrong. And that hurts now. And so to do that, the hardest thing, this is why Zen alone didn't do it for me. I needed therapy too, because Zen is a really easy place for me, kind of the opposite of what you said, not to be duplicitous and get away with things, but Zen was a really easy way for me to discount my own experience and to put myself down. And what therapy helped me do was to go into a situation like that where, okay, I'm going to receive a worldview that includes kicking my ass over some bullshit that he was probably wrong about anyway, and accept that that's true for him while not denying my own reality too. So to be able to do that, I have to be able to hold two contradictory things at a time. And I can't now be convinced that, which is ironic, I get it, that isn't just actually a more rational way of dealing with the situation. Because if I don't accept his reality, I have to do gymnastics to cut off all that. And then actually, if I just want to be skillful and protect myself, I'm at a loss. I'm flying 3/4 blind. So I can only see what I want to see then. So if I want to be honest with the world, I've got to admit that so much is happening that I'm not okay with and I don't agree with. And to do that and keep my own moral compass, I've got to be able to split the world in two. That's my version of it. The real answer is, it's a great question, and I hope you have fun with it. That's just my example. It's your reality, not mine. We're out of time. We're a minute over. Oh, my God. Well, y'all, I'm going to miss the shit out of you. I will absolutely miss you. I hope you guys have a wonderful time this spring. I'll see you on July 4th. I'll be home. Thank you so much to everybody for everything you're doing. just showing up is the best thing you can do to help while I'm gone. But also everybody who has jobs, we really appointed like 15 officers. It's great. Everyone has a job now and an arena they take care of. So thank you so much to everybody pitching in and doing that kind of stuff. It's good Zen. I'm happy to see it. And yeah, no, thanks to everybody for everything.
I'll take a picture.
Okay, I want to take a picture. You guys want to be in the group photo? You can go if you want to.